This podcast is primarily recorded on the traditional territories of the Huron-Wendat and Haudenosaunee peoples, in Cataraqui, or Kingston by its colonial name. We center the rightful stewards of this land in order to unsettle our fight for collective liberation. Hi, welcome to Queer Muslim Resistance, a podcast from OPERG Kingston. I'm one of your hosts, Maha, and today we have the pleasure of speaking with our first guest, Cole, a queer Ojibwe and Métis beater and artist, currently living on the unceded and unsurrendered territory of the Algonquin peoples, colonially known as Ottawa. We have an awesome conversation about beading as medicine, as a ritual to ground yourself in community and home, and what it means to center the land and Indigenous sovereignty in queer Muslim struggles and activisms.
So I do have an icebreaker question for us. And the question is, if you were a tree, where would you be planted and why?
Okay, can I introduce myself first?
So that... Yeah, of course.
Great. Ani Bozo Kol Nadishnakas, Mamazi Zigabawateg Nadishnakas, Anishnabe Aki Ndonjaba, Migizi Odana Ndonji. Hi, my name is Cole Poplinski. I use they, them pronouns. Cole is my given name, and I was also given the name Wrestling Pine by a Two-Spirit elder. My family is from Migizi Odana Eagle Village First Nation on the Quebec side, but I was born and raised in North Bay, and my mom's side of the family is Métis from along the Ottawa River. I think it's really important that I like introduce myself in the language as best as I can, as it's a part of like my reclamation journey.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you.
So if I was a tree, where would I be planted and why? Oh my God. So I got my name. I know that was like one of your other questions was like the relationship I have with the elder who gave me the name and like what kind of like how that process worked. So for me, I was born and raised in North Bay. I was so like off reserve. My family, like we always knew like colonialism is weird and like indigeneity is like wild that like you, if you're not raised like with traditions, like you'll know that you're racialized, but it's like, all the identity and like traditions are like locked away from you. It's like very weird. So as a part of like reclaiming my journey, I started reaching out to elders a few years ago, and I've been lucky enough to meet Two-Spirit elders and my elder Blue Waters. I gifted her tobacco, and tobacco is our medicine. It's like a contractual medicine. It's also the medicine that when you put down your tobacco on the earth, it's the messenger medicine. So it brings your messages and your prayers to Creator. Mm. So I gifted her tobacco and she put it in her pipe and waited to see if my name, colors, and clan would come to her. And when I gave that to her, like, you know, when she was in town. She lives like in Peterborough. And then when I was actually on a trip in Banff, for a moose high tanning residency, when I was like, you know what, I should just like message her, see if she has heard anything. And so I messaged her, and she gave me my name. And it was kind of fitting because I was like surrounded in the mountains, like in Banff, like working on the land and like learning all these things. So it was really beautiful. So I think if I was a tree, I would be one of the like rotten like spruce stumps that like we were using for smoking the moose hide tan, like the moose hide, and I would be a part of that process. That's where I would be. Nicole, are you like laughing?
I'm like crying because it's so beautiful, and I was trying not to cry because I was like, I can't, you know, I would told you guys I was gonna cry when I saw you all on tape together, but I just think that's really beautiful.
Yeah, I think for me too, like reclaiming indigeneity has always come with that little bit of discomfort and like undoing those Western ideologies that like we've had to adhere to for survival. Mm-hmm. So Anishinaabe people have like 7 sacred teachings, and one of them is humility, and that one has been sticking with me a lot lately, and not in the way that like, oh, be humble, don't brag, but in the way that like, ask the hard questions, wait for those hard answers, like get out of your comfort zone and learn those things that are so vital to our existence that have been hidden or lost, and try to like reclaim those things. So that's what I've been trying to do with like learning the language or getting my name and talking with elders. So I've been fortunate enough that like I'm able to do those things.
That's so lovely.
Nicole, would you want to answer our icebreaker question? If you were a tree, where would you want to be planted?
I think I would be, I don't know what kind of tree I would be because I don't really care, but I would be by the water because I just kind of want to hang out and just, I don't know, that's where I love being, and I think that that's where I'd want to always be.
And I thought it was really interesting, I was thinking back while you were speaking, Nicole, to Cole's answer, because they didn't pick a living tree or a healthy tree. You picked a rotting tree, which is used for, you said, drying hides, right?
Yeah, so in the final smoke process of the like tanning process, you like sew the hide into like a tube, and you put like all the like rotten spruce wood in the fire, and it gives it that beautiful like smoky smell and that like brown color on the like leather on the smoked hide. And it gives like, I have, it's so, it's like such a like comforting smell. It smells like campfire. I think we often, especially like in Western society, often think of things as only having a purpose when they're alive, or like when we can extract resources from them, but I think it's so beautiful that with this like spruce, like stumps here, you are taking something that Western society would deem as like unusable, but you're still using it as like, it has, still has a purpose. So I think like, I mean, and we can like tie that into like just like grief in general, like when we think that things have like done, have finished their course here, like there's still like an afterlife, there's still something, you know, you don't just like end, there's still uses. And I think you can even tie that into like the moose moratorium, you know, the whole reason that people are upset is because the hunters are just killing baby moose without like regard for the population numbers or their life. And Indigenous people, when we hunt, when we, you know, not everyone, but we try to like use the pieces, all parts of the animal for its spirit. And, you know, I think picking a tree that maybe not, isn't what we like normative, what we think of when we pick a tree, I think like is beautiful in a way.
While you were saying that, it made me just kind of think too about how everything's cyclical, right? And yeah.
Also, if I was a rotten spruce, maybe there would be mushrooms on me, and that would be really cute.
I would be the cutest rotten spruce, honestly, real.
Taylor, do you want to answer the question?
See, so every time I've thought about this question and answered it, I've always thought, you know, I would like to be a full grown, beautiful living tree on the edge of a hill or a cliff of some sort, overlooking water. That was my scene. But now, and I did used to say this, but I guess I never introduced this to people because it's a little bit morbid. But I always said I would like to be cremated and turned into a tree. And I think it would be so cool.
Yeah, my partner has always said that too. They're like, I just want to be a tree. And so I think that's like super common and like not, I think that's so beautiful. And that goes back to like that like cyclical way of being, and like that when your journey ends, it actually doesn't end. It like just turns into something different in your beginning. mm-hmm. yeah. something different. I love that.
When Taylor was saying that, all I could think was, oh my God, I also have always wanted to become a tree. And because like we talked in the last podcast, like I'm not religious, but like I do love the idea that you like continue to give on. And I think that like you don't just go. And I think I would want to be able to stay in nature and just like kind of give and just chill.
Yeah. Better than a cemetery for me, I think.
Hell yeah. Don't worry.
Also, no. Cemeteries are so colonial and mm-hmm. like whose bodies are deemed like worthy sacred enough to have space in a cemetery, you know? Yeah. Like whose bodies are being put there and who, you know, ancient burial grounds getting disturbed like from construction and things like that. So it's like who's safe? Like even in death, like, you know, yeah. I'd rather be a tree.
mm-hmm. Yeah. What about you, Baha?
So when I've thought about this question before, specifically and talked with Nicole and Taylor about it, I said that I would like to be a tree living in the woods. And then I was like, I'm not too sure if I actually would because of bugs and stuff. But then like, you know, if I were a tree, I would enjoy the bugs and the nature. So I feel like it would be really neat to be part of the woods because I would just be part of this whole community of this whole ecosystem of other beings that rely on each other for space. And I think, Taylor, you were talking before as well how like the tops of trees all fit together so that each tree gets enough sunlight and like they don't block each other, right? So it's like this beautiful interconnected web of living that I would like to be a part of.
And the roots talk to each other as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, that's, yeah.
Can I re-answer this question? So the more that everyone has been talking, the more I've realized that I would still want to be over water. Mm-hmm. But, like, I don't really care where it is because I just kind of want to, like, I don't know, the idea of being a tree to me means being, like, a home for everything mm-hmm. that's around you. Mm-hmm. And that's how I just like to be. I like to be a home for my friends. Like I like to feel at home, and I think that that's all that matters. And also I just want to be by the water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, can I say, like, I feel like Nicole, if you were a tree, you would be one of those like really badass trees like but on a riverbank where like the river has eroded some of like the dirt so you can see the roots, but like you're hanging on, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You would be like one of those like really cool, like you like walk on the river and you're like, how is this tree even here? But it's so strong.
Oh, that's like the best. I'm gonna cry.
Oh, no.
So I guess, Cole, I wanted to ask, generally, who are your people?
Yeah, so my people are the Anishinaabe from Eagle Village First Nation. So I'm Ojibwe, and then on my mom, that's on my dad's side, and then on my mom's side, I'm Métis from along Ottawa River. Yeah, those are my people. Again,
how do you love?
How do I love? Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
Yeah, we get deep on this podcast.
Real quick.
I'm like, how do I love? I think through time, like quality time is my love language. And I think like spending time and being present and like listening and being vulnerable, like those are all like pieces of like how I love.
What does being present look like for you?
Yeah, so I think that means like I feel like oftentimes we're like in this capitalist society, we're like taught that you have to keep going and that you're only worthy of something like when you're producing. Mm-hmm. So I think like being present for me means like just being in someone's like space and like not being on my phone or doing something else, or if I am doing something else, maybe it's like I'm beading and I'm like pouring my energy into something like that's connecting us rather than mm-hmm. like distracting myself from being like in the moment. So I think, yeah, being present looks like giving like all of myself or like a big part of myself to the moment and not like trying to distract myself. Cause I feel like a lot of the time, like we're always like distracting ourselves, or like I am personally like distracting myself to like survive to the next moment. Right. So being present looks like taking a break and like sitting in that uncomfortable, like sitting in that uncomfortable silence, sitting in the like awkward, sitting in the love, sitting in the like joy, and like sitting in all those moments.
Mm-hmm.
We spent so much of the summer when we would see each other, Cole and I, just like beading and doing embroidery. And it was just kind of nice.
Yeah. So like we would still like chat and like be present with each other, but we were like still doing something that was grounding. Mm-hmm.
Time is really big. We've known each other for a while, but we like grow distant and grow closer like the longer we know each other and are living together or in the same place.
Yeah. Yeah. So Nicole and I have actually like we met in school like years ago. And Nicole and I have like a relationship where like we will like be really close for a long time, and then like life happens and we like drift apart, but we always come back to each other, and it feels like very comfortable and nice. And like that's really special, like when you have a friend where like you can like with wherever life takes you, you know you're gonna like be solid no matter what.
Yeah.
And that's like why I think beading to me is so important. Mm-hmm. So I found beading 3 years ago when my grandmother, my nana on my mom's side, she was actually not Indigenous, but she was married to her husband who is Métis, and she was like really involved in her friendship center and like just like for the time, like now thinking back on it, I'm like, wow, Jeannin Bell, like you were a badass woman. Cause she, mm-hmm. like, if you think back to it, like in the 80s and 90s, and like when my parents were growing up, like to be Indigenous was like not a thing you wanted to be open about. Like on my dad's side of the family, they were very like, they're very brown. My dad is very dark. You can tell he's Indigenous. But it was like one of those things that you like don't speak about, because like residential schools like were still a thing. And but my nana on my mom's side, like she was not Indigenous, but she like made it her mission to like raise us like with whatever like teachings she could like find. So mm-hmm. she like would go to her friendship center and she like would join the drumming group. She was like beading. And so she like tried to like bring that to us, which I think is really beautiful as like an accomplice. Mm-hmm. So when she passed, I actually inherited her beading stuff. And so I used that as like a way to honor her and like grieve that, like her passing on to the spirit world. And so beading has become like one of those like medicine, it's like a healing for me.
Yeah.
In a way that like I'm focusing all of my energy and putting like my like spirit into something, and it's grounding, and I'm doing something with my hands, but I can like think, I can like listen to music or just like sit and be with myself and like really focus. And like I feel like a lot of the time we don't ever take those moments to just like sit. Because especially as like racialized people or queer folks or like living at any marginalization, like we're so much of our survival depends on us just like plowing through things and like just surviving.
Yeah.
If we sit and like think about like all the shit we have to deal with, it becomes overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for me, beating is like a part of that, like doing that in a way that's like manageable. I'm like taking in like bits and pieces of mindfulness and checking in with my body when I'm beating, or like checking in with my spirit. And like, yeah, so instead of just like being overwhelmed, I can like still do something that's like grounding me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How do you do that process of checking in with your body and your spirit?
I think it just kind of happens naturally, like when I'm beating, like I feel like I don't even know how to explain it. It just feels like when I'm beating, it feels like I'm connected to something. Mm. Like I can feel my ancestors, like it's like I picked up beating super fast. Like I taught myself like from YouTube videos, and like, and then I would meet like other beaters and they would like teach me tips and tricks. I was trying really hard not to say tits, but I was like tips and tricks, but they just wanted to come out tits. Anyways. So I like, for me, that checking in kind of happens like when I'm beating, and like, yeah, because I can feel like I'm, it's like when I'm beating, it's like a bigger picture. It's like I'm beating like, not just for me, but I'm like right. beating for community, and I'm like,
you're not alone.
Yeah. And I can like feel it's like in my blood, like if that makes sense. And I think like a lot of the time we often, especially around like Indigenous issues, we often hear the phrase like intergenerational trauma. And I think like, yes, that trauma is intergenerational, but so is like the wisdom and the love and the resiliency. And like, honestly, I hate the word resilience because it's been like used and like weaponized. But like that resiliency and that like survival and those like dreams of my ancestors, like when I'm beating, they all become like to the forefront. Like I can feel it.
It's a big fuck you to colonization as well. Doesn't die, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Also, like, when, and, like, it'll be, I would love to hear this from your perspective, like, both Taylor and Maha, but, like, when you're racialized and parts of your culture are deemed, like, are demonized, and parts of, like, your spirituality are demonized, like when you can do some of that or like reclaim those things, even if it's just like for yourself or in your own spaces, like it feel like Nicole was saying, it feels like a fuck you to colonization, but it also just like feels grounding and like magical. Like I'm, and it also feels like I'm honoring what our ancestors have always fought for and like honoring them. I think a lot of the time it's really easy to just focus on like the shit that's happening. We can like focus on like the deaths and the like tragedy and like what's happening like across Turtle Island with like Indigenous rights or just in general. But when I'm beating, I can focus on that strength. And I'm very lucky that I have something that I can feel that way with. And I like, it breaks my heart that some people don't have something that like I'm really lucky that I can bead and like feel really that connection and that support just like on my own. And I wish that everyone else could have something like similar, especially for like racialized folks where we're constantly like expected to just survive, and beating actually makes me feel like I'm thriving in some way.
I was just gonna say, like, for me personally, a big part of reclaiming my South Asian-ness, because I've always had like quite a strained relationship with being South Asian, a lot of internalized shame, like a big part of reclaiming my South Asian-ness for me has been buying art by other South Asian artists, queer art specifically. Like in my room, I have a beautiful, beautiful painting of South Asian queer women dressed in all this beautiful clothing, kissing, and it's the most beautiful painting. And then I also have The Rani's Affair. So it's like a queen and her servant, and then her, like her husband is like looking. It's like, it's a very interesting painting. Nicole has seen it.
Yes, it's beautiful. I'm obsessed with it.
Yeah. And so that's been a really important part of reclaiming me for me. What about you, Taylor?
I was thinking, it's so interesting, I don't have any, or at least I can't think of any mindful practices that I do that I've carried with me aside from prayer. It's the only thing that I'm like, you know, and I guess when I say prayer, I guess I also mean singing, because a big part of praying for me is praise And I express that a lot with singing. And, you know, being raised Catholic and in a very, very colonial Catholic country, it's hard to disconnect, and you can't disconnect the religion and how it is taught and practiced from the reality of why it was taught and practiced in this way. Mm-hmm. And it took a while for me to work with that. And yet I still feel, and I come back to my grandmother, you know, taught me this and continues to teach me how to have a relationship with God. And even if it's not her way, you know, her teachings have stuck with me. And so prayer and talking to God and singing and just releasing my soul in a the most raw and honest way has been actually, it is the biggest hope and comfort and hug, ancestral hug, I feel, even though it's not connected to my ancestors at all, but it's something that I took from my grandmother, who is my most, like, you know, the matriarch of our family. She's so important to me. So I feel connected both to God, but also a practice that I think I can develop in a more fruitful way than what I was taught in mm-hmm. prayer. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. And I think, like, also just like, I relate hard to your piece about like that complicated relationship with religion and because especially like I was also raised Catholic. Like I went to a Catholic school in North Bay, like wore the uniform, did the whole bit. and I also have like a complicated relationship with religion because at the hands of colonization, that was like the main mm-hmm. tool for assimilation. Mm-hmm. But then you speak with elders, like Indigenous elders, and you have to realize that like for them they've taken in some of this Catholicism and mixed it with their Indigenous mm-hmm. tradition. So there's like almost this like this melting pot of religion, and you have like I want to respect like my elders, but also like be aware that like religion has hurt us in big ways, but also mm-hmm. like the parts that they take out of it are like so meaningful and life-saving for them. So like mm-hmm. finding a way to like balance all of that and like, oh my God, it's complicated and nuanced. And like, because I remember the first time I heard an elder like talk about church, and I was like, wait, you go to church, but like you're a residential school survivor, but like mm-hmm. you were like hurt really big in big ways by this institution and by like people who represented this institution. But that relationship with God, whatever that looks like, is bigger than institutions, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's bigger, it goes beyond that. Like there can be both. And mm-hmm. I think that's so complicated for people to like understand.
It is.
Do you have any questions for me specifically?
Yeah, like, I guess, like, my only question would be, like, so this is for about part of your research. Tell mm-hmm. me about your, because I started listening to the first episode. I got, like, mm-hmm. 10 minutes in, and it was really good. I'm really excited to keep listening to it. Mm-hmm. But tell me a little bit about, because you're in gender studies, mm-hmm. the master's, yeah.
Yeah, so when I talk about queer South Asian Muslim femme art, I talk about art in its most broadest sense. I remember initially when I was coming into this program, I had two visual artists in mind that I wanted to look at, but since then I've been able to access like poetry and novels and creative work. Yeah, so it's been really fun. This summer I just wrote a paper. I can't believe that phrase just came out of my mouth. But it was really fun. I wrote a paper on on queer South Asian Muslim poetry and art and documentaries and whatever else there is out there. Just exploring how they basically are so invested or cannot be invested in future making projects, homemaking projects, and the narratives that tend to center men tend to be the least critical, tend to be the least revolutionary, because they're still working within heteropatriarchal conditionings, right? These male-centered narratives tend to center or tend to exclude the fact that, you know, if they're located in what we call, you know, the States or Canada, they don't tend to focus on the fact that they're located on stolen land. They'll tend to claim Americanness or Canadianness as a way to celebrate their queerness because queerness is co-opted by the state, right? So it's very, I've had experiences where I've critiqued in my paper narratives of gay maleness that don't work critically to position themselves where they are and to relate how they came to be, what they're doing, how their complicity in settler colonialism and in imperialism, you know, overseas as well. So I also looked specifically at this wonderful scholar, Gayatri Gopinath, and she uses the word female specifically, but I've chosen to use femme as a way to, you know, disrupt ideas of colonial ideas of gender, even though femme is not all inclusive, it's not a catch-all phrase by any means. But in using like a queer diasporic framework, you're able to unsettle what it means to be in the diaspora, right? Because there's like a binary relationship between the origin state and the impure diaspora, right? Which is an immature, impure copy of the nation. When in fact, people in the diaspora are not an impure copy or always relating back to this originary nation. We're also right where we are right now, which I think a lot of people tend to forget. And so the ways in which we fight, the ways in which we resist oppression, queerphobia, Islamophobia, specifically racialization, whatever else, however else we're positioned, needs to focus on Indigenous sovereignty, essentially. Because all of these struggles for justice are connected. And colonialism must be eradicated from Turtle Island to Palestine to Kashmir.
Oh my God. Okay, wait. Going back to you looking at art, and not just looking at art, but like, I want you to send me some Instagrams to follow.
Yeah, for sure.
Because I love following like queer artists and racialized artists. And I feel like that representation is so important and we don't see it, right? And like most of my Instagram right now is like beaters and like Two-Spirit, like folks, like, you know, but and like Black scholars and but I love, like, we never see South Asian queer representation, or if we do, it's very masculinized. Like you'll see like, you know, like gay men or like gay, like art that centers masculinity, because that's just like patriarchy, you know?
Oh, for sure.
So Cole, what does practicing and working towards queer Indigenous sovereignty mean to you?
Well, I think like going back to what you're saying, like all of our struggles are interconnected, right? Mm-hmm. Like they're all, and like, it's done that by design, right? And like, you haven't said lateral violence, but like you're speaking of it, like, you know, our communities, I think like even just like this podcast where we have like a Black femme, a Muslim South Asian femme, and like a white femme, and then myself, a Two-Spirit MB, like all on a call together is revolutionary, right? Yeah. Like the fact that we're all sitting down and we're relating and we're having these conversations is like huge, because like we're coming from all these different lived experiences. Like my experiences are going to be very different than yours. But we're able to relate on like this very like basic intrinsic level of like being queer and racialized in some ways, and like being from different parts of the world and like having different diasporic feelings or experiences. Because like that to me too is like diaspora is like, it's interesting because like I'm technically on my homelands, but like do I have connection to them? What does that connection look like? It's policed by like this colonial settler state, so like can I have the relationship with my homelands as I want? No. And so like I think like Indigenous queer sovereignty looks like reconnecting those relationships and like building those communities of care between our various communities and like building those bridges instead mm-hmm. of burning them.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like a lot of the time, like the oppressive state is like expecting us to just be like, we're different and like, let's fight amongst ourselves. So we're not focusing on the oppressor. And I think like you see, you know, like Indigenous and Black solidarity in the movements like that have come just like this year. And, mm-hmm. you know, Black liberation can't exist without Indigenous like liberation and vice mm-hmm. versa. And like, mm-hmm. we need to like all of those, all of our struggles are intrinsically linked. And mm-hmm. like, and I think like, it's really easy for people to distance themselves from certain things. Like that's all what privilege is, right? Mm-hmm. It's like distancing yourself, being like, I'm a queer man, but I'm not racist, or I'm not this, or like, I'm queer, so therefore I'm more woke, or like mm-hmm. whatever, right? Which we all know those like white cis queer men who mm-hmm. pretend to be like really like woke, but like just like co-opt Black AAV, like Black language, and co-opt like yep. Indigenous spirituality, and like, oh my God, and co-opt like South, mm-hmm. like South Asian culture, and like,
mm-hmm. yep,
co-opt all these things that are not their own, just to be like, we're being queer and we're like queering things, but you're just taking the labor on the backs of like all, mostly like women and femmes
mm-hmm.
and trans women who like are literally making it so that you can exist.
Yeah.
So I think like I think it all comes back to like relationships, and whether that's mm-hmm. like relationships with each other or relationships with our land, mm-hmm. and like what that looks like. I think a lot of the time we think of land as like a dead thing that, oh my God, am I gonna quote Pocahontas, but we just land is just a dead thing you can claim. But yeah, like there, when we start to like decolonize this idea that land is just like a thing you can claim or like extract resources from, but we realize that we're like living in relation with the land, and that mm-hmm. it's telling us things, and we need to listen to it and like nurture that relationship, I think it's like plays into a big part. And then I think also like, let's just take queerness and like relate that to the land. Like you hear like there's like a disconnect just from like mainstream queerness with land. Like what is it to be queer? Like mm-hmm. A lot of mainstream is like going out or doing mm-hmm. like, it's very social, but we don't take time to like do those mindful practices and to like take a second and be present. And I think that comes from like this process of always like going and always surviving. And like, mm-hmm. I think as queer people, regardless of other intersections, we have been persecuted by like society where it's hard for us. Like we're always like just trying to survive to the next mm-hmm. day.
Right.
And so we forget these like important factors like the land and our relationships with each other and ourselves, because we're so busy surviving. So I think Indigenous sovereignty and queer sovereignty looks like taking that time and not only just surviving, but like taking time to like be like, okay, what do I need to thrive?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we make that happen?
As you were talking, Cole, I was thinking about, I got the pleasure to work with Dr. Catherine McKittrick as my supervisor at Queen's, and her research looks at Black geographies. And I've been trying to make sense recently, in these last couple of days, make sense of, diaspora and being diasporic in the sense of, you know, not claiming one place as home, not claiming mm-hmm. one place as a place of complete comfort and rootedness, I should say. And I've been trying to understand, so we also talk about not claiming placelessness, right?
Yeah.
Not claiming not having home, but looking at those relationships. And I think it's, for me personally, when I think about Black geographies, I think about relationships, both, I guess, larger relationships, such as structural relationships that my Black body has to the Canadian state, for example, and who's allowed in, and how hard it is to immigrate here, and how hard, if you do get here, how you can't go back home for a very long time, etc. But it is very difficult to think of those relationships on a smaller scale in relation to physical, like the land and where we are, because it feels a lot like you know, community in numbers, right? Which is how it's frequently represented. You have, if you go to Toronto, you'll have all of the, you know, distinct cultural communities. And so it's sort of recognized like a second, you know, a second home, Little Italy, a second place to where you're not. And if you're outside of those geographic, you know, cultural zones, it is very hard to reconnect relationship with land and being here on this earth in these communities outside of our own communities. And I'm speaking specifically coming to Kingston. It feels very white. It feels extremely white here, and trying to make sense of that whiteness, but also what I can do as a non-white person, as a queer person who wants to do queer work in this space, on this land, within my community. And that's not distinctly connected to being a diasporic person, as in, you know, finding home in the diaspora. I put home in quotation marks. But I think for me, it's been quite difficult connecting my relationship to my physical geographical space, as well as with the relationships I have with others in my community, the work that I'm doing. It's very hard for me to make sense of that, because the land has always been positioned for me as you belong here or you don't belong here. Either you have your community here or you don't have your community here. And what does that mean? I'm trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to work it out, and it's confusing for me.
Yeah, I think also, like, we have to remember that the land has been weaponized, right? Like, it's been used by colonizers, by the state, to separate us, and to make that harder for us to, like, piece together. Like, in the same way that we talk about land as, like, a living thing, as, like, something that we can be in relation with, like, it's also something that can be used and abused, and we see that happening, like, all over. And so the land has been turned into this weapon to like, keep us in our place, essentially. So, like, we need to figure out, like, unpack some of that, which, like, I think is what you're speaking to, is, like, unpacking that is so complicated. Like, it sounds like what I'm saying, it's like, oh, just unpack it, it's fine. But, like, it's, like, so complicated and so interconnected with everything. And, like, when I think, I like when you say, like, you're not claiming, like, not having a home or not having a space, but that, like, relationship to a home feels complicated and strained. And, like, what is that home? Is it community? Is it people? But then when you throw queerness on top of that again, then it's complicated, right? Because going back to religion, like, Catholicism are, like, really ingrained in our racialized communities, that, and, like, certain parts of our queerness are not accepted by our own communities, and then we fall through the cracks. Like, we can't exist in our racialized communities, but we can't really exist in mainstream queer communities, because they each leave out a big piece of us. So it's, like, almost having conversations like this and creating these spaces for ourselves, that that's how we, like, in my opinion, like, that's how we start to unpack that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, like, I think a big part of for me specifically, as a non-Indigenous person here on stolen land, a big part of trying to unpack all of this is trying to focus on building community through relationality, through the people that I'm around, and not centering or de-territorializing, because it's not my place here to necessarily claim someone else's stolen land, right? But it's also important to recognize that as a non-Indigenous person, I have a role to play where I am based right now. And I don't know, I feel like it might be useful for folks to kind of understand why we're having these conversations about centering land on a podcast about queer Muslim resistance. So there's a lot of interconnected issues, so I'm just going to kind of try and break them down as best as I can. But so Islamophobia on Turtle Island is perpetuated by war on terror discourse, and that's a critical tactic of settler states, right, in order to justify colonialism and imperialism, so that in many cases white men can save brown women from brown men. That's a quote paraphrased from Spivak, such as through military intervention. And of course there's the added layer of homo nationalism, or state sanctioned ways of being gay specifically, where the LGBT framework is co-opted by settler states in order to prove their inherent superiority and civilizing powers over folks, who, or communities that largely relay anti-queer sentiment, right? They villainize racialized folks from places that are now predominantly anti-queer due to colonial logics of cisgenderness and straightness that were imposed and enforced in South Asia, for example, by the British, right? Creating and enforcing categories of what is normative and thus defining what's abnormal in relation. So white people criminalized anything beyond heteropatriarchy in settler colonies and then used their creation of anti-queer sentiment as proof of a lack of civilized development of racialized folks and Muslims in particular to advance their own agendas of domination. So that's kind of where I'm coming at it from as well.
Well, and you this is not new, this happened. I've used the term two-spirit to describe myself, and I don't know if listeners know what that is, but two-spirit was a term created in 1990 in Winnipeg at a gay and lesbian intertribal conference. So Indigenous peoples across Turtle Island, prior to settler colonialism, there were two-spirit beings who were thought to be born with, or thought to live in balance and harmony with both masculine energy and feminine energy. And the way that we, prior to settler colonialism, gender was very not based on what was in your pants or biology, or it was more based on your role in community. So if you were a hunter, that was what you did. If you were a basket weaver or taking care of children, two-spirit people were often, because of this duality and this balance, were given really important roles in their community. We were actually usually the first people to meet settlers. And so when settlers met two-spirit people, they were really confused and not down with it. So gender is used as this tool to as assimilation, right? So it's used as so the patriarchy was used to break down matriarchal societies and to position Indigenous women as property of men. And it created this what we know today, and that's where we get in high numbers of missing and murdered Indigenous women and missing and murdered Indigenous men, and all these other high really shitty statistics, because of this integrated belief that certain people are less than, this idea of taking this homo nationalism and certain people are deemed as okay. That's all been done here on Turtle Island, and like it's just history repeating itself. They're using these tactics of like, here's how you fit into civilization. And now they're like flipping those scripts on their head to be like, well, you're still not civilized, even though like now, like, yeah, it's just, it's all complicated. And it's, yeah. We can see the histories, like as much as different as the experiences are, there is that like common thread of relation between both experiences. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So Cole, how do you see your practice or manifest towards the futures you deserve and the futures that your people and your community deserve in your daily life?
I think just by existing, mm-hmm. I'm doing a lot of things. And mm-hmm. I think by loving, loving and living, I'm like manifesting those things and putting them into the world. Mm-hmm. I'm also like polyamorous and queer. So like I date multiple people, and I think like queering those relationships and queering this like idea of monogamy, mm-hmm. like also is like a future that I want to see. I want like love to not be like so boxed in, mm-hmm. what that means. Like I want to be able to freely love someone based on like what that dynamic looks like between us and like what we communicate that love to be. And like, mm-hmm. I don't want to have to follow a relationship escalator. I don't want to have to follow like a set way of like, my love is meaningful because I've done X, Y, and Z. Like I want to do what feels good in the moment for both people or all people involved. And I think, yeah, like that's how I manifest those futures, is just by like speaking them into existence and being like, I deserve those things, and unpacking, like, you know, we've talked a lot about colonialism and this violence and all these other things that like box us in. And I think it can be so easy to like internalize that and be like, I don't deserve good things because the world is telling me that I don't deserve to even be alive half the time.
Yeah.
And I think finding people and letting love in and letting people tell you that you love, that you're loved and that you deserve love, and that, and like whether that's like being told in words or being shown in other ways, that's fucking revolutionary, and that's beautiful. And so like that's what I'm trying to do, is like I'm 28 years old, I've gotten to this point where like I definitely didn't think I was going to make it this long, or like be, you know, I was a depressed teenager living in a small town who was like Indigenous and queer. And like, did I see myself making it to adulthood? No. So now I'm like, okay, I'm an adult. I have these things. Now what do I do? Like, how do I can have a future? Like, what does that look like? And I have like, to answer your question, do I have an answer? No, but like, I think I'm trying to figure it out. Like, yeah. I'm trying to, like, now I'm like, okay, like, we don't know what the future is going to look like, but I'm going to make the best of it because I have one now. And a lot of people in my, with my intersections don't have that, mm-hmm. That chance. So I think like, I want to create those futures and create those spaces for people like me or not like me. I just want, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And when Cole was speaking about how they view love, it really resonated with me, because one of the things that I have a really hard time with is the idea like of how people view relationships, because I think that like your friendships are relationships too, and like you should be able to celebrate the love with your friends that you have, and like that's pure and that's like precious, you know?
Yep, 100%. I was just gonna say that, Nicole. I was also going to say, I love how you started with and highlighted love and loving relationships and sort of decolonizing how we love as mm-hmm. an important, radical, and very, very queer practice, because exactly what Cole said, a lot of the relationships we've been conditioned into have been alienating and isolating and to box us in, right? And the magical thing about being queer and loving queerly, so practicing queer futures and and imagining queer futures, is that I feel like they're led with love. They're led with friendship and connection and centering the relationships we have with people.
So what would you like to bring with you into our radical futures, and what would you like to leave behind?
Oh my God. Let's leave all the colonial bullshit. Mm-hmm. So I guess I want to have children. We haven't talked about this, but like the reason we first all connected is Nicole connected us because we were all talking about like babies. Yeah, because like I want to carry a baby soon, potentially. And we're in the process, my partner and I are in the process of like working through fertility stuff. We've narrowed down a donor and like.
Congratulations! Oh my gosh!
You taught me that you could find donors with like their zodiac sign. Did you end up using that? Because it was.
Oh my God, yeah, we definitely, on one of the websites, like you could tell it was made for queer people because they put their zodiac signs in the profile of the donor. And I was like, oh my God, but no, we used a different site because this guy had more files. I think for me, the future, like going back to like, what is like love and like, and just like talking about love, but like, I hope that the future like brings a lot of love and a lot of compassion and communication and honesty and like that humility and like to have those hard conversations, but like coming from that place of mutual respect. And I think like bringing kids into the world, like I'm so like some of the time I'm like, oh my God, how selfish is it of me to like bring more brown babies, more Indigenous babies into this world that's gonna like try to break them down. But at the same time, I'm like, that's like, I want more future generations, and these babies are going to change the fucking world. And like, I think of like the beautiful things that we've said just on this call and this podcast. And like, we're going to arm our future generations with that. And like, you know, we're queering love, but we're also queering the future, and we're queering those narratives. And I think that's like so fucking beautiful. And I can't wait to see like what my child has to teach me in the future. Because we never stop learning. And yeah, so now I'm just gushing about babies. And
I never thought about children, our children teaching us.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. It's such a two-way street. Like I've talked to other queer parents, and like, even like from when kids are like a toddler, like even when they're a baby, like they're communicating with us.
The entire time that you guys were talking, all I could think about was how whenever people kind of ask me about my future and children, like if I end up with a partner who wants to carry, like whatever, maybe I want to foster and adopt older kids. But I think about how, okay, first off, I really want to have a house with Maha and Taylor and whoever wants to come with us. But like, I think about like, I got so excited for Cole and JoJo because like they want to have their baby, and I'm like, I'm going to be an aunt. I'm going to be everybody's godmother. And like, I don't know, like every time I think about Maha's future babies, and it just makes me so happy because I think that family, like, I mean, I'm in your family, like, and I can't wait to help you guys like raise your kids. And I think that's like such a beautiful thing about queering love as well, is that it's not a question to me. Like, I know that I'm going to be there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that.
And I think like, that's what I'm excited for, is like we have all these notions of like what a family is supposed to look like, and what, like going back to like what a relationship like escalator is supposed to look like. And I'm like, no, I'm gonna do it my own way, and I'm gonna invite as many people that into my child's life that I see fit in different capacities.
We all have so much trauma, and we've all gone through so much, and it's beautiful to know that like your kids are going to be able to have people to talk to that they might not have before. Mm-hmm. And also, like, I love my family, but I also love the people that I've chosen to be in my family who help me feel stronger and love me, like, because of my trauma. And I don't know, it's just one of those things that, like, thinking about the queer future and thinking that, like, hopefully people will have places where they don't feel consistently alone. is really beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there anything that you would like the listeners to take away from your stories, Cole?
I think I would just like to leave everyone with, like, the message that, like, we're all coming from a place of learning, and we're all coming, like, that our learning journey is never over. And that doesn't absolve us from, like, our accountability, like, when we do make mistakes. But we're all learning, and we're all trying to, like, navigate these messy systems that have been designed to keep us down. Mm. And we're all doing the best that we can. And I think it's really important that we take that away with us and, like, try to be as respectful and, like, under, like, meet people where they're at, you know, and have those conversations. Yeah, I think, like, I want people to know, for, like, young queer Muslim folks or young queer Indigenous folks, young queer, like, anyone, I want you to know that you're not alone, and, like, these conversations are happening, and we're making them happen, and all of our complexities are fucking beautiful, and we're, like, these conversations, we're going to build these fucking futures, and, mm-hmm. like, we're coming for you, you know, and, like, we got you, like, mm-hmm. I just think, like, I just remember, like, teenage me, like, feeling so alone and, like, so helpless. And now I look, like, to where I am now, and I'm, like, having these conversations. I never thought these things were possible. And I just, like, I want people to know that these things are possible. And, like, even though there's so much shit, there's also so much beauty.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Even though there's so much shit, there's so much beauty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you need that fertilizer to make the flowers grow, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, I think that's it.
Yeah. Ha ha ha, fertilizer shit. I just got it.
Oh my God.
I'm like, yeah, I guess fertilizer is good. I'm like, sure, fertilizer. Well, I don't know why they said fertilizer. And then it came to me a few seconds late, but that's okay.
I love that. Oh my God. I went, yeah. Oh my God, that's so cute.
Is there anything you'd like to plug? Where can people find you?
Oh my God. Yes, so you can find me at two places. So I have a personal Instagram, it's at Mild Pets, and that's, like, where I share, like, stuff going on in my life, mental health stuff. And then I have a beading Instagram called at Rustling Pine. You can also find my website at mm-hmm. rustlingpine.com. I will be releasing a fall collection of beaded jewelry and patches on Thanksgiving on October 12th, because I was like, fuck colonialism, pay me instead.
Yeah.
So, so this collection is, like, all blacks and golds and bone colors. And so it's, like, really stunning and kind of spooky, kind of witchy, but, like, not in, like, a campy Halloween way, but, like, in a elegant, like,
Coy.
Exactly. So, yeah, and I've also, you can find stuff on my website, like, any upcoming projects are up there. So I'm currently in the Carleton, I have a piece in the Carleton University Art Gallery right now as a part of their exhibit, To Be Continued, Queering the Archive, which is, like, an exhibit about queering Ottawa's history. Mm-hmm. So I have a piece in there, and I'm always busy, like. So if you want to stay connected, my website is always being updated, and my Instagrams as well. So.
Awesome. Love that. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Migwich. Is there anything else that you want to share, or, like, thoughts and feelings?
I mean, it's important for us, as us, I'm talking about queer Muslims specifically, in our fights against colonialism, that means actually talking about colonialism and our place within colonialisms. So that's all I wanted to leave with people.
Thanks for listening to our first guest episode of Queer Muslim Resistance. Make sure to check out the episode description for links to some of the artwork and books that we mentioned. We'll see you again next Monday with our first Queer Muslim guest.
You can follow us on Instagram @QueerMuslimResistance for more updates on the podcast and resources.